My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagratz, and we are back with the Western Bubble podcast. And we are knee-deep in the summer, meaning there are a crisp 24 degrees here in Berlin, and I assume somewhere around 40 degrees in Madrid. As we promised before, next week in our final episode of the season, we will be looking into solutions to the problems of the Western Bubble. But until then, we kind of want to look back a little bit at the past season and just compare some of the biggest issues that we've covered in season four today from when we talked about them. Hi, Balder. First of all, how warm is it and what topics are we speaking about today?
Hi, Dario. Well, as you very well know, it's indeed close to 40 degrees, and that's not something to either make fun of or to emphasize too much, because it is, you know, it's tough. It's hard. You walk out and you walk into this wall of heat. But okay, at least we live in the luxury of air conditioning and life is good. So we can actually discuss some actual important topics. And we made a quick list in advance of this episode. First, we're gonna have a quick fire round where we go through a number of brief issues just to mention them. And then we go into a little bit more detail with respect to the situation in Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, unavoidably, of course. We'll talk a little bit about Iran, about UK elections, and about President Joe Biden, who is still running, even though nobody really understands why.
And for this, we will not be following our usual structure, so no wonderful jingles here. Again, we're just in a nice summary way we're going through this. And as you said, we're starting with a quick fire round, right? The way this goes is in any debate or social media formats. I will be reading out a sentence and then you will have to complete it within, I would say, a word or maybe two, three, four words, depending on on how eloquent it's supposed to sound, but not longer than one sentence maximum.
Fair enough.
Starting with the first topic that we've chosen, and this is going all the way back to episode 57, titled Reconnecting with Venezuela. Balder, the Western embargo on Venezuela is?
Gone.
Okay, gone. Very good. That's within the one word. So what exactly do you mean with that? I mean, I didn't hear a big announcement out on the news that, hey, we're trading again with Venezuela.
Well, yeah, that's true. What's happened is that over the past 10 years, of course, there was all of a sudden this hype of, hey, we can get rid of the Maduro regime because the Maduro regime is not in line with our own ideology. We don't like the way they are dealing with their own country. There was this real hype around the opposition for a short period of time, specifically around Guaido, who was the opposition leader. That then turned out to be nothing, because no change actually occurred. And then the West began boycotting, embargoing the country. But what does that do? That leads to Russia and China going in and saying, okay, thank you very much, we'll add this to our sphere of influence. And this has damaged the Western position, and now the West is slowly, without actually, announcing it, because it's nothing to be proud of, slowly re-engaging with the Maduro regime. And they're even using the upcoming elections as an excuse, right? Like, hey, all of a sudden Venezuela is democratic again, there are elections, so now we can deal with the country again and get some slice of their oil reserves, essentially.
See, particularly before the upcoming elections, this is one of the episodes that, in case you've missed it, would be very good to go back to them, right? Because we will not be publishing any episodes throughout our summer break. But here, this is maybe one of those that might make sense to go back to. Just as an episode that was shortly after, that's episode 59, called Global Conflicts We Forgot About. And here's actually two topics that we want to cover. And the first one is about Yemen. And Balder, here's the sentence to complete. How many Westerners know about Western warplanes flying airstrikes against the Houthis this week?
I want to say 83, something like that.
Is that 83% of the population or 83 people?
No. I actually meant literally 83 out of about a billion people. The strikes against the Houthis, and just a the whole militarization of the region is something that has gone completely under the radar for most people. And what is fascinating about that is that you have countries, including, for example, my country, the United States, of course, the United Kingdom, of course, but also the Netherlands, essentially bombing Yemen, for better or worse, you can debate that, but military action against Yemen, and the Dutch population doesn't know about it, doesn't care about it. And that says something about how we have militarized our foreign policy, right? How we are nowadays at ease with using the military to solve problems. And that contrasts with our image in which it's China or Russia that are all the time being militarily active, and as if we are just peaceful peoples that want to make the world a better place. No, we are bombing the world and we don't care, apparently.
And this is taking place in the country with the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet today.
Exactly, where again, the West has had a lot of responsibility there, right? The fact that the United States supported the Saudi war in Yemen, and the whole war on terror environment in which this happened, the whole situation with Israel, all of these things contributed to enormous humanitarian hardship, enormous suffering in the country, and we are happily bombing there as if that is a legitimate thing to do.
Moving on to another country that we don't talk about a lot, MONUSCO, the United Nations peacekeeping mission, leaving the Democratic Republic of Congo is?
Essentially a formal admission of the UN being pointless and worthless.
Because the situation has not improved compared to 20 years ago, right? We're still looking at the same, I mean, the same environment in which humanitarian situation is not amazing and conflict is happening. I mean, it's going up and down, right, in waves. Sometimes there's more, sometimes there's less. But ultimately, the mission has not achieved a lot.
No, it's exactly what you're saying. So depending on the year, there's more or less violence, but there is absolutely no solution in sight to the continued instability in the Eastern DRC. There has been no solution even offered, really, and it's been completely obvious that the 20,000 peacekeepers did not actually improve much. They did not do much, and the local population is completely fed up with their presence there. Now, when I say that the UN is worthless, I mean it in this specific context. I will always insist that there is room for a round table where countries cooperate and work together. But when it comes to the Democratic Republic of Congo, this has been a shameful episode of UN peacekeeping.
Mm-hmm. Moving on in our quickfire to episode 47, when we talk about the coup in Niger. And here the sentence goes, the Western position in West Africa is?
One of almost total surrender.
Because we're no longer really present there, right? So the French have pulled out. This is what we discussed in that episode. And we also, quite frankly, we're not hearing about it a lot anymore.
No, because the West has pulled out. So basically, the moment we decide that it's either too embarrassing or no longer interesting for us, we don't report about it anymore. And this is one of the problems of Western media, right? Western media very much go with those geopolitical flows, and they love emphasizing those issues where the West looks good, where the West seems to be making some kind of positive difference. But whenever there is a clear failure, then, you know, we stop talking about it, we stop caring about it, because it doesn't fit into our own delusional image of us being a force for good in the world. And in the case of West Africa, you know, I think surrender is probably the reasonable thing to do. The West has nothing else, and this should be up to African countries to deal with. But it is astounding how only 5 years ago there was military presence by, again, the countries I just mentioned, always the same kind of countries like the Netherlands, the UK, the United States, France. And now it's essentially Russia and China being the main geopolitical powers in the region.
Moving on from West Africa to Haiti, to episode 75, a very recent one titled Haiti Failed by the West. And the sentence goes, the West staying out of Haiti is?
Finally, lessons learned.
Right, basically very much in line with what we discussed in the episode, that After the history of France, of Germany, of the United States and Haiti, despite the very bleak situation right now on the ground, right, with a lot of humanitarian suffering as well, it might be a better option for the West to actually stay out of this.
Exactly. And the reason for that is that the West cannot separate its own interest from the actual humanitarian interest, right? This is always a common problem with these situations, that the West goes in formally to make the situation better. The same could be said about Southern Sudan and even the DRC and all these other places. They go in saying, hey, there's humanitarian suffering, we want to help. But then a whole baggage load of other interest, economic interest, military interest, geopolitical interest come in, and thereby the presence of the West actually doesn't solve the problem for the local population. It makes it worse and it damages the Western reputation. And in the case of Haiti, it seems that the West, at least now, is finally a little bit more reluctant to do anything about it. And I would argue that until they figure out a completely new way of dealing with it, that's good news for everyone involved.
Moving on to the last topic of our quickfire round, the French parliamentary elections, kind of connected to episode 81 that we recorded on the European Parliament elections, where we discussed Macron calling these snap elections. And the sentence goes, Marine Le Pen winning the first round of the French elections is...
not a surprise, even though for some reason everyone pretends to be shocked, but this is the result of years and years of political evolution in France and Europe in general.
And then the response by basically the political establishment, right, by grouping together for the second round of elections, basically saying, okay, we're so scared of the right wing that we're now all going to pool our sources together to stop this. It's fighting the symptoms, it's not fighting the root causes.
And arguably exacerbates the symptoms in the long run, right? So they might keep Le Pen out. As we're recording, basically, the elections are going on. We're recording this on Sunday the 7th, so we don't know the results yet of the second round. But they might be able to keep Le Pen out of a majority by doing this in the short term. But in the long term, it only... seems to legitimize the feeling among large segments of the population that there's an establishment who want to keep their votes and their unhappiness down, and thereby would make things much, much worse in the long term.
Okay, now that we're done with this quickfire round, right? I don't know about you, but it felt a bit stressful to me, right? Kind of, our regular audience knows that we have a tendency to dive deeper into topics, but this one felt a bit stressed to me. I don't know about you.
Well, yeah, we like to blab a bit and we like to take our time and sometimes even become a bit repetitive, and that's hard in a quickfire round. So let's not do this too often, Dario.
Absolutely. So one of the topics that we want to dedicate a few more minutes to is obviously the war in Ukraine, still happening after, we're now inching in on 2.5 years. It's actually quite some time. And there's two topics here, right? So the first one is one that we've discussed in multiple episodes over the past, but it seems like we're the only ones who are discussing this. I'm talking about the bombing of the Nord Stream pipelines, where it seems like, right, Denmark, Sweden, they have all dropped their investigations. The Germans are still pretending to be investigating, if you ask me. But it seems like from the European political elite, there's no interest in these investigations. Yet there is a survey that came out a month ago that basically says that 2/3 of Europeans are still concerned about there being no results of the investigations yet.
Yeah, and... it surprises me a little bit that 2/3 even know about Nord Stream, because the media is not covering it, right? I mean, once in a while an article, but it surprises me that people actually don't answer, I don't know what Nord Stream is. At a slightly more important level, I am absolutely astounded that the media hasn't done this, right? I am astounded that there is not more discussion of this. And it shows once again that kind of indirect, implicit relationship between politicians and media. Because what would be the reason why the media, why politicians are not interested in the investigation? Because they know that the outcome is not going to help them. When would the outcome not help them? If it's anyone not called Russia, basically, right? The only thing that would be useful for politicians if it turns out that Vladimir Putin single-handedly blew up the pipeline. If that's not the case, and it seems pretty obvious that that's not the case, then politicians don't want to hear the answer to the question who did it, because it might be very, very uncomfortable, as we have discussed in the past. But that the media then doesn't actually want to analyze that further either, that is a really, really big deal, because there's an enormously interesting journalistic story here.
So in the preparation for this episode, I obviously kind of did a quick Google search on, okay, what actually happened with the Nord Stream investigations, because it might be, right, it might be that for 2 days you're not looking into the news and some big news item on it breaks and you're just missing it. But no, there has been nothing. I mean, that's how I found the survey, right? And another interesting article I found is that actually in April, China at the United Nations called for a UN-led investigation into the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines, which, I mean, either tells me two things, that the Chinese are very, very interested in this pipeline, or that Russia does not seem to be as scared of an international investigation as maybe others, because, I mean, Russia has also repeatedly called for an international investigation into this.
Well, that second point is completely obvious and also fascinating, right? Russia has been quite consistent in this sense, because they know that they haven't done it. So they have nothing to fear from an international investigation. Of course, they don't trust the Europeans. Of course, they don't trust the Americans to do it, for obvious reasons. And the fact that China calls for this is a confirmation that Russia is okay with that, that Russia would like some kind of neutral observer to look into it. China would not call for this if Moscow told them not to do it, because why? There's nothing to gain for China otherwise. The other really interesting observation here, I find, is that it's yet another sign, as there have been many signs in the past already, of China feeling more and more comfortable to use and even weaponize the UN against the West, right? Which is, in many ways, good news for the world, because the UN should not be some kind of Western bulwark. The UN should be responsible, accountable to the entire global population, and not just a few that started it 80 years ago. But on top of that, it also shows that China is becoming more and more confident about its position at a global level. So in that sense, that's an interesting news item. Not much will come of it, because the UN is still very, very clearly influenced by Western politics. But the fact that we're still, after all of this time, none the wiser about what actually happened is absolutely astounding and a huge indictment of Western media more than anything.
One of the topics that we will be covering in our episode next week, when we are trying to fix the West. Another item very interesting when it comes to the war in Ukraine to me is that now for 2 years, right? So I'm going to take the first 6 months of the war out. But for 2 years now, it seems like we've been trapped in a three-month cycle of, you know, every 3 months, it's basically either like it's saying that, oh, Russia is really advancing on the ground there. North Korea is sending ammunition and Iran is sending drones. And they found some old Soviet tanks, and I don't know, somewhere in the garage that they will now be sending to the front line, and they're advancing and Ukraine might fall very soon. So the West really needs to step up their commitment to Ukraine, right? And then a few weeks later, we're seeing that, oh, Russia's offensive is really not doing well. It's basically only going to be another 2 years until Russia runs out of steam. They're already asking female prisoners to serve at the front, and they're trying to get mercenaries involved. I don't know. Are we stuck in one of those bad movie plots, right, where like the same day repeats over and over again until you found the right solution?
Yeah, Groundhog Day, which is a brilliant movie that everyone should watch. A little bit. So what you see here is this need for the media to paint a clear picture, right? Reality is complex. The reality of the war in Ukraine is very complex. It's there's no obvious winner. You could argue that everyone is a loser because of the enormous destruction and enormous suffering that mostly the Ukrainian people are feeling. But the military analysis and the long-term sort of political analysis is muddy. It's not clear. And yet the media desperately want to tell a narrative, right? They want to say, oh, it's clear that we're now at breaking point, and we all need to support Ukraine to make sure that Russian tanks don't drive into Kiev. Or they want to say, oh, it is clear that Ukrainians are winning, and finally we will see Putin get a bloody nose or something like that. And of course, that doesn't correspond with a really, really difficult situation where once in a while a little bit of military gains are made by the Ukrainians, then they're made by Russians. But the bigger picture is that it's basically a standoff. It's almost like a World War I scenario of trench warfare where there is not much happening except that every day destruction takes place, people die. Over the long run, it's likely that Ukraine will run out of resources, certainly human resources, soldiers, people, faster than Russia for obvious reasons.
Mm. Oof. Moving from one pretty dark topic, right, with a lot of humanitarian suffering, to another pretty dark topic with a lot of humanitarian suffering. Let's move on to Israel-Gaza, where there is, the last time we spoke about Israel-Gaza, we kind of talked about 30,000 people dead, even more injured, right? Famine, huge humanitarian suffering on all ends. And now we're talking about it again, and now we're a lot closer to 40,000 people dead and no solution in sight. Because if anything, it seems like that the Israeli siege mentality has grown even stronger.
Yeah, and then we should also say that those 40,000 people dead doesn't count the extra deaths because of lack of medical care in general, right? So if you have cancer, you are much less likely now to get support, to get hospital help, than you would have had a year ago. So the actual number of victims is much, much higher. And it is, well, both horrific and fascinating, just from a distance, non-emotional perspective, to observe how Israel is digging itself deeper and deeper into the siege mentality, right? And the fact that only last week there was this news that they have now formally approved, or the Israeli government has formally approved, the annexation of West Bank land, the largest amount of annexation so far, show something about the siege mentality, because in no world, in no scenario, is this something that Israel should do right now, just from a selfish perspective, right? If you're the most diehard, ultra-Orthodox, Zionist settler there, you should also then understand that you don't want to feed criticism against you right now. And that's exactly what Israel is doing. It seems as if they're almost, they don't care anymore about the rest of the world's perspective on Israel. It's like, we are fighting and we will continue fighting, and either you're with us or you're against us, and we're not going to in any way be intelligent about our marketing, about the way we present ourselves. And that is, of course, terrible news for everyone involved, because it's the sign of a military machine without limitations, essentially. And it is the sign of a country that is no longer in touch with reality.
Because, right, so basically foreign policy 101, right? If you do a quick stakeholder analysis of all of this, one of the biggest interests of Israel is obviously not to lose its allies. It seems like right now they're doing a pretty good job at scaring them away further and further. The United States and Germany are obviously still there for obvious reasons, but are making it more and more difficult by the day. But even if we look at the ground objectives of Israel, right, and that has always been bring the hostages back. By now we've rescued very few hostages, and a lot of soldiers are dying on a daily basis, right? So you're not even in a net plus when it comes to human lives saved by this operation. There's just nothing, at least to me, that makes sense about this operation from an Israeli perspective. And we don't even have to start about the other perspective, because there's obviously only suffering on that side.
Yeah, and it really shows a certain level of insanity, which maybe can be explained by deep historical trauma. It can be explained by the history of Israel that has gone through cycles, internal politics, also external politics. But it is completely obvious that it is now no longer a rational actor. Israel is not a rational actor, at least from a governmental perspective. And the fact that there aren't every day millions of Israelis in the streets protesting this behavior is also a sign of a population that doesn't know what it's doing anymore. And I say that as someone who's not an expert on Israel, but just as an outsider observing this deeply, deeply destructive behavior. Now, I will say this, and that's kind of interesting from a broader perspective as well, outside of this specific conflict. In the West, the hype is over, right? In the West, the people care less now than they cared 6 months ago. So when 6 months ago, during the height of the hype in the West, when everyone had an opinion and everyone was talking about it, when I said, hey, there's other things in the world happening as well, now we are the only ones still talking about it because everyone else has moved on. And this is similar to the invasion of Ukraine. You know, the first few months, everyone was talking about the invasion of Ukraine. Then it dies out. It's similar with all COVID, you know, all those kinds of things. And maybe Israel is kind of banking on that, that the West just doesn't care enough anymore because they're tired of the news. So they just let Israel get on with it. But in the long run, of course, the damage is very, very severe, both in terms of Palestinian suffering, but also the Israeli position in the world. And Israel's heading for a very difficult few decades with very little empathy or support from the rest of the world.
Hmm. I mean, just to add to this, I mean, there are protests, but it's more like tens of thousands rather than millions on the street, which you said. Let's kind of stay within the Middle East, but move on to the next topic, to one of the topics that we've actually discussed in one of our very first episodes, right? When we talked about the Iran nuclear deal, and here we're talking about Iran, because Alder, 2 years ago, right, in our basically second episode, I think it was, we talked about the Iran nuclear deal, and in there we quoted intelligence, right, from different Western actors that said that Iran is this close, and for the audience that can't see it, I'm pinching my fingers together, to getting the nuclear bomb, right? They're basically weeks away. Alder, that was 2 years ago. And yet we're still reading newspaper articles, again, just published last week, that Iran is only weeks away from a nuclear bomb.
But just as I said 2 years ago, this has been a common pattern ever since 1979, or maybe the early 1980s. In the early 80s, there were reports from the Mossad, from the CIA, from Western European intelligence agencies, all saying, again, Iran is this close to nuclear weapons. They're going to develop nuclear weapons and we have to stop this. And over again, the cycle repeats itself. As long as I've been teaching international relations at universities, which is quite a long time by now, I have been saying this to my students. Look at these documents. Look at this document from 1981. Look at this document from 1995. Look at this document from 2005. All claiming that Iran is about to get nuclear weapons, and then even worse, use those nuclear weapons offensively to either wipe out Israel or strike against the West or something like that. And every time, every year that I'm teaching it, I'm sort of thinking by myself, oh, I hope that this won't be the year in which finally the West gets proven right, right? Because my point is all the time, look at this nonsense. Look at how they make these claims forever and it doesn't happen. And every year I'm a little bit nervous. And then it turns out that I had no reason to be nervous at all because it just is not happening. It is one of those psychological cycles in which the West can't help themselves. It fits their narrative. It fits their ambition to isolate Iran, to make Iran out to be this evil source of destruction. And they just essentially make up nonsense.
Another development that has happened in Iran the past few weeks, so basically during season four, is that President Raisi died in a helicopter crash, where we now have seen elections, right? And in these elections, actually a moderate candidate won, which has not really, there has not really been a reaction from the West, right? Usually, hey, there's elections, that's something good from a Western perspective. A moderate candidate has won. Well, that's good, maybe. But this time, that hasn't really happened.
But once again, because it doesn't fit into the Western narrative. So the fact that there are elections at all is kind of uncomfortable for the West because it seems to suggest that Iran is a little bit more complex than we give them credit for, right? So that in itself is something that doesn't really fit our perspective. We'd like to think of Iran as just some country ruled by evil ayatollahs where nobody has any say in anything. Whereas in reality, the political and intellectual environment in Iran is much more complex than that. And that's not me defending the politics of Iran. There are lots of things that I personally feel very uncomfortable about. But I also have to recognize that Iran is a complex and very large country with a very long and proud history of political and intellectual debate and conversations and universities and academics and all that kind of thing. So the fact that there are elections at all seems to humanize Iran in a way that the West doesn't like. If then a moderate wins, that makes it even more confusing for that Western narrative, because we'd like to think that it's always the Ayatollah that just putting their evil conservative puppets in power, and that's clearly not the case in Iran. So now, the word moderate is a little bit tricky in the case of Iran, because of course in European terms, the moderate candidate would be an extremely conservative politician. But from our podcast perspective, the takeaway here is that we desperately are trying to paint a picture of Iran that doesn't correspond with reality. We do that at a foreign policy level. We do that when we analyze the politics of Iran. And instead of saying Iran is a very complex country with lots of different dynamics, we just want to pretend that there's some kind of existential threat to us or our allies or anything like that. While at the same time, we happily do business with Saudi Arabia, which doesn't have any elections at all, no serious ones that have any impact, and that is much more authoritarian than Iran could ever be.
Moving from one set of elections to another one, to the ones in the United Kingdom that just happened last Thursday, a few days ago. And so this is a very dark day for the Western bubble, because one of our most prominent supporters has basically lost her seat in the House. We're talking about Liz Truss. She unfortunately, just like many other Tories, has lost her seat, and that's very sad for us, because who is now going to give us a reason to talk about the United Kingdom?
Yeah, I mean, of course, Liz Truss is so far out there that she was brilliant for people like us, because it really confirms all our darkest thoughts about what they were doing over there. This was coming, right? The only surprise here to me is that this didn't happen in earlier elections. You know, that this continued after the Brexit debacle, after the insanity of Boris Johnson and Liz Truss for so long. But the fact that the Tories are out now is, of course, long overdue. The takeaway here is that people voted against Liz Truss, against Rishi Sunak, against the Tories. They didn't really vote for anything, right? They were just completely and understandably fed up with a very, very destructive 15 years of policymaking. But there is no real enthusiasm about Labour or the Labour government, because they haven't really put forward anything to be enthusiastic about.
Right. So this is something I texted you on the night of the elections, where I basically said, oh, I thought the German election system, right, electoral system was crooked, because we have these overhang mandates and we have a direct candidate and a list candidate for proportional representation. It's very complicated. I don't think Germans understand really what we vote for. But then I looked at the United Kingdom and I thought, oh, okay, maybe I'm glad that we have such a weird system, because Labour only received 32 or 33% of the votes, but gained 2/3 of the seats in the House. That's, I mean, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but that doesn't seem right. So people didn't really vote for Labour.
Yeah, so I think the exact number was 33.7%. And you're absolutely right, there's something really odd about that. Now, I'm always a little bit torn in this conversation, because a lot of people in the UK have, for the past two decades essentially, been making the case for proportional representation, saying this isn't fair, this isn't right. I do think that there's some kind of value in having your own local representative which, for example, doesn't exist in the Netherlands, and parliamentarians in the Netherlands are completely anonymous. The same in Spain. Parliamentarians in Spain are completely pointless in a way because you don't have any personal connection with them. In the UK, you do. And the fact that we have all those characters that we now know lost yesterday, that says something about at least a personal connection with all of this, right? And I say yesterday, but that's not quite right. It was 3 days ago. It seems like yesterday. But yeah, so the system is an awkward and kind of uncomfortable system in that way. What is much more interesting to me, though, is that actually the number of people in absolute terms voting for Labour has gone down. The number of people voting for Keir Starmer in his own constituency has gone down quite significantly. So he won his constituency, obviously, but fewer people in his constituency voted for him than last time in 2019. Jeremy Corbyn, who has been vilified by media and the Labour establishment and everyone else for being too much of a socialist and an anti-Semitic leader in within the Labour Party, he won 40% of the vote when he lost the elections. He won something like 5 million more votes than Keir Starmer did last week. So there's a problem here. There is a complete lack of enthusiasm.
Right, because for context, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn was the prior basically leading candidate of Labour, right? So that's why this is so significant. And then we might ask ourselves, okay, where did all of those votes go? And surprise, surprise, as everywhere right now, they went to the right, to the populist right.
Yeah, so now the UK can finally join the ranks of European countries with the extreme right. They now formally have it. So in the past, you could argue that they were sort of covered within the Tory party, something that, for example, here in Spain also existed for a long time, where the extreme right was part of the Partido Popular, which was sort of right of center with some extreme leanings. Now that has all split up. So now the UK also has an extreme right-wing party. And the analysis here surely is that if nobody is enthusiastic about Labour, but they vote for Labour because they want to get the Tories out, and all of a sudden you've got a very large amount of people voting for the extreme right, who, by the way, got very few seats, only 5 seats, even though they got 15% of the votes or something like that. The failure of the establishment here is very clearly not having a narrative that people can connect to, that gives people some sense of purpose. Voting for Labour because you are against the Tories is a terrible reason to vote for Labour, right? But that's all that they give you, apparently. And so this is something very worrisome. And that's the same as we mentioned previously about the French elections, right? Voting for establishment parties because you desperately want to keep Le Pen out of power. Well, that is kind of a sad reason to vote.
And I feel like that's the same, right? Voting for an octogenarian, Joe Biden, just to keep Donald Trump out of office is also a very sad reason to vote, right? But that's currently the reality that somewhere between 80 and 90 million Americans will face in November, because I would say most of the listeners have also heard or at least seen something about the debates that took place 2 weeks ago. I must say, I was a bit shocked, right? I mean, because I have seen Joe Biden maybe talk 2 sentences at length in like different news snippets, and you read about him. I didn't know how bad it was. And this is the first time in basically since the last election, I listened to the man speak for more than 90 minutes. And boy, I mean, how is this happening? This man is so old. He can barely, I'm so sorry, but he can barely walk. And he performed this badly after having a full week of basically naps and catering all day long in Camp David.
Yeah, so you call him octogenarian, but that's kind of doing him, you know, doing him a service. It's not sufficiently describing the problem here, because let's face it, 80 is the new 65, right? People are much healthier than they used to be. Joe Biden is the oldest 81-year-old I've ever seen in my life. I mean, the man is really, really old for his age. Now, that's not a surprise. He was president for 4 years, or 3.5 years now. That takes a lot out of you. He was vice president before that. there can also be genetics involved, but he is an 81-year-old that is no longer operating normally. The issue here is not that he had a bad debate. The issue is that this is the latest in a very long line of evidence that he is not equipped to be president. There was even a judge who told the world, essentially, hey, I can't put Joe Biden on the stand because he is too old. He doesn't remember things. He doesn't remember when his son died. He is too forgetful for me to use him in a legal proceeding. If that is the case, how is it possible that the Democratic Party put him forward still as the candidate without any opposition, essentially, and only now, after the debate, pretends to be shocked? Oh no, he's actually not performing very well. He's not actually putting sentences together, at least not in a coherent way. He seems to be forgetful and falling asleep. We all knew this. We knew this for over a year, for 2 years. And all of a sudden now there's panic. Well, that's a bit late.
Sometimes I'm late to the party. it's genuinely concerning. And the reaction to this in the media landscape, right, was the New York Times, the editorial board, basically calling on the Democratic Party to not nominate Joe Biden. I mean, there's still a chance of them not nominating him, right? Basically only if he steps down. The media has called on them to step down. Some very few prominent Democrats have called on other Democrats for Joe Biden, basically to not be nominated. But it is a little bit late, right, for that. And also, there's no real, I don't really see an alternative. And all of this is just such a picture-perfect example of what we've been discussing in the past few weeks, particularly in the last week with the Supreme Court, with kind of like the, old people clinging on to power and the establishment saying, well, he's the best we have. Well, if he's the best you have, then good night.
Yeah, and it's maybe not even so much he's the best we have, but he is the one who will perpetuate the dynamics that we're comfortable with, right? So it's the problem with establishment politics always, not just now, but throughout human history, is that they want to maintain the dynamics because they're uncomfortable with what would happen if those dynamics change. And so the establishment said to itself, hey, let's not create any uncertainty. Let's just have Biden there again. The people around Biden are the ones that we can work with, the ones we're comfortable with, and things will be fine. Well, it turns out that things aren't fine if you don't actually look at reality, if you don't care about content. Because in many ways, it's fascinating that people are talking about, oh, can he beat Trump or not? Which is a fair question, which is an important question. But nobody's actually saying this is currently the most powerful man in the world. He is the one who can decide on nuclear war. A man who is clearly, clearly too old to remember things, too old to actually be even a mid-level manager, is president of the United States right now as we speak. That is shocking. And the establishment let that happen. No wonder that people are turning to extremist parties, because the establishment doesn't respond to the needs of the country.
I mean, the response to this is always, oh, but there's a good team around him, right? And I mean, I'm someone who has said this before. I mean, 4 years ago, I said, oh, well, Biden is going to assemble a good team and they will hopefully kind of make sure that there will be a good succession process. But there is one problem with this. Again, if it goes on for 4 years and if it goes on beyond that, because there's simply a lack of accountability. I mean, it's great that you have a team of technocrats kind of running the country. I mean, we have discussed this in the past, and I mean, I'm no stranger to that idea. But from a Western, right, bubble perspective, aka what makes the West strong, right, these strong liberal democratic institutions, that's a terrible idea, because there's no accountability to any of the actions of his team, because you can't hold, I mean, you can hold the old man accountable, but he doesn't know.
Accountability and legitimacy. And exactly what you're saying, I've been amazed how even really left-wing commentators, like properly left-wing commentators who don't like the Democratic establishment, have said, well, I'm kind of okay with the situation because at least he's got good people around him. But those good people around him do not have political legitimacy. They weren't elected, which is a fundamental principle of a well-functioning liberal democracy, that the person in charge, not his advisors, the person in charge, is the one who makes choices because they were elected by the electorate. And then accountability. So whenever something bad happens now, no one is going to blame Biden because we all know he was asleep. And so who are we going to blame? Who is going to be fired? Who's going to take the responsibility for things going horribly wrong? This is really, really bad. And it seems that too often we are forgetting about the content of these issues. We forget about the actual reality, the day-to-day affairs, and we talk about the political spectacle around it, right? And we care about, oh, the only thing that matters is beating Trump. No, I think what matters is that this president today, in July 2024, actually can do his job properly. And yet we are all so filled with sort of the theater of elections and the theater of us versus them, the theater of Democrats versus Republicans, that we completely forget about what really matters: policymaking and accountability, legitimacy, and all those kinds of things.
This seems like a great moment to end today's recap before the summer. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them in our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we present solutions for problems in the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
And this is a quote that might as well be a bit of advice for us in the next few days when we have to think of solutions for the next episode. This is a quote from Albert Einstein, who said, "We cannot solve our problems with the same level of thinking that created them."